Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 12th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Esther Men. Today's session number is 98.9, and it's titled Singing God's Praises, Psalms in the Church's Song. Psalm 46, A Mighty Fortress is Our God. Let's listen in.
My name is Esther Men. And this is the final session in a series that's been looking at the Psalms and Christian song, where every day we've taken one psalm and examined it, tried to get at what it's saying and some of the associations and structure and so forth. And then we've gone on and we've looked at two or three hymns from the Christian church, and we've seen what parts of the psalm have been drawn upon and how it's been changed and so forth. I offer this series of sessions as a way of reflecting about the practice of singing in the church, which is one of the practices that's discussed in the book Practicing Our Faith, which has a wonderful discussion of singing. And it notes that really churches and synagogues are the few surviving places where people come together and sing together. And it's an important part of the identity of the communities of faith. They remember their past and celebrate who they are today and pray through song. So today we're going to look at Psalm 46, which is a short one. In contrast to Psalm 104, which we did yesterday, which really we weren't able to do much except go over the surface. But today we're looking at Psalm 46, which is another psalm of confidence, similar then to Psalm 23, which is our first psalm that we looked at the beginning of the week. But there's different imagery here, whereas Psalm 23 was very idyllic, pastoral, with those images of the shepherd and the host. We have very different imagery here today, much more violent. So why don't we just get started here and read the psalm all the way through, then we'll go back and look at it section by section. Would anyone volunteer to read the first three verses? We'll probably divide it first three and then 4 to 7 and then 8 to 11. It seems to break down into three sections. Yeah.
This is a good chance for me to ask. When you read a psalm, are you supposed to say the word Selah after whatever it is after you read it orally?
Well, that's really optional. It's in the text, but it's kind of like stage directions.
Well, so you wouldn't read that?
Probably not if you were, if you were actually performing. Most people, I notice, most people don't read this superscription either to the leader of the Korahites according to Alamot, a song. You know, when I say, will you please start? Then people don't start with that. They start with the verses. And the same thing with the Selah is kind of an indication. We don't really know what that means, actually. It's some kind of designation, musical performance designation that we've lost the meaning of. And it may mean something like, okay, now we're going to have a musical interlude here, or pause, or everyone stand up, or repeat the last line, or we don't really know what it means, but it does mark significant divisions within the psalm. So that's very handy for us here, so we can see exactly how they were performing it, the divisions that they saw. So it's handy that way. Although it does lend a kind of, authentic, you know what I mean? People say Selah, it sort of really marks it as a psalm because it's the only time they ever hear that word.
Well, I didn't. I just wondered if people were hesitating to read because they wondered about that question, which always wondered about. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's optional. Okay. You can, as you will. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to start?
I'll start.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. Reading glasses.
Excellent.
God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam through the mountains, though the mountains tremble with its tumult.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Would you like to continue?
There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High.
God is in the midst of the city, it shall not be moved. God will help it when the morning dawns. The nations are in an uproar, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
Okay, very good. And the final section? Would you like to read?
Come, behold the works of the Lord, how he has brought desolations in the earth. He makes war cease to the end of the earth. He breaks the bow and shatters the spear. He burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
Oh, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. What strikes you most forcefully as you're reading this psalm? Is there a certain image or a certain tone, a certain message that you get?
War.
Mm-hmm. A lot of violent imagery in this psalm. So it really is a contrast to the 23rd psalm, which is another psalm of confidence.
Mm-hmm. I like that line. He utters his voice and the earth melts. He's something as constant as the earth just melts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other first impressions?
What else? I always like the line, be still, and know that I am God.
Uh-huh. Be still, and this is a beautiful, be still. We've had so much, you know, even the mountains are moving and melting, and the oceans are moving, and the armies are moving, and everything's moving. You have this violent movement throughout the whole psalm, and then there's a little prophetic oracle at the end where you have first person speech, divine speech, be still. A wonderful contrast there. Well, I think what I'd like to do at this point is go through the three sections and describe them, become more familiar with them, and how the psalm moves from the beginning to the end. We've already touched on some of those things, like that concluding be still as a contrast to the sort of violent movement and that emphasis on the mountains and so forth. But let's go through a little more systematically. If we divide it as it's probably divided in your Bibles, is that true? Is everybody's Bible break it down just like that? Into 1 to 3, 4 to 7, and 8 to 11. Mm-hmm. Let's start with this first verse or stanza. And how would you describe, could we break this down further into a couple of parts?
Well, it seems to be two major sections. Verse 1 sort of stands by itself, saying God is our refuge and strength.
Mm-hmm.
And then verses 2 and 3 talk about, you know, God's constancy, even though all these other things are going on.
Okay, good.
So we will not fear, even though the earth changes, the mountains shake, the waters roar, mm-hmm. the mountains tremble.
Mm-hmm. So in the first verse, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. So we have these descriptions of God as refuge. Someplace you go and there's trouble all around, right? Someplace that you seek to hide yourself when you're in danger. So refuge, strength, very comforting noun there, and help. So you have these strong terms describing God. And it sort of sets up a mood of confidence right at the very beginning, I would say. But then in the second two, there's a statement that therefore we will not fear, but actually most of these verses are spent in describing exactly what there might be to fear, right? And it's really hyperbolic. Though the earth should change, the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, waters roar and foam, mountains tremble with its tumult. So the whole cosmos is sort of up in upheaval, and even the most enduring things, you know, the mountains so forth are not strong. They're toppling and so forth. So you have this sort of cosmic chaos described. Sort of one image of the type of trouble that we might need help for, help in very cosmic terms of the mountains and the sea. Any other observations about this first part? Well, let's move on. Do you need Bibles up there? You're all okay? Just checking. Let's move on to the next part then. And just to get it back in our minds, you want to read it again? Somebody?
Second part?
Yeah, would you? Mm-hmm.
There's a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy habitation of the Most High. God is in the midst of the city. It shall not be moved. God will help it when the morning dawns. The nations are in an uproar, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge.
Okay, thank you. So do we have any change in imagery?
Well, there's a real contrast from this part, from the beginning part, that the chaos initially is the earth moving and waters, and now the chaos is that the nations are in an uproar in the kingdom.
Okay, good. So we have this cosmic chaos in the first part to in six, right? You have instead of cosmic chaos, you have armies. So you have kind of human chaos of war, right? Imagery of war. So you have armies instead of mountains and ocean. But there's kind of a parallel here that's being drawn.
I think it's interesting in the first verse that there actually is no river in Jerusalem, but this is imagery portraying God as the river of life that flows through the city.
Mm-hmm. Excellent point. So we go from these waters of chaos in 2 to 3, which are shaking the mountains and roaring and foaming and tumulting, and then in 4 we go to this image of a river. But it's not a terrifying river, it's a river that makes glad. So there's a real shift in the water imagery. It links the two verses, and yet it's a transformation of that image of water. Now it's streams that make glad the city of God. And you're right, there's no major river at all in Jerusalem. There's a little spring that the Gihon...
But they have this kind of effect.
Mm-hmm. A little stream coming out of... it's not even actually in the temple area, but the Gihon is there, but it's very small. I don't know, have many of you seen it or seen pictures of it? Mm-hmm. It's, what is it like? Oh, it's not like even like Railroad Creek here.
No.
It's more like one of the little spring melts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But this image of the rivers and associating a river with Jerusalem in the temple is actually a repeated motif that you have in the Old Testament. I think one thing it does is it begins to make an association between Jerusalem, the city where God's temple is, and Eden. Because in the second chapter of Genesis, Eden is seen as a place with streams flowing from it. It's the perfect place. And so that image of the river flowing from the temple kind of associates Eden and Jerusalem. And there's this image of this water flowing from Jerusalem is repeated in a number of places. You have the prophet Ezekiel, for example, and he's living in the 500s before the Common Era, and during his lifetime the temple was destroyed. So he has at the end of his book of prophecy, he has this vision of the restoration of the temple in chapter 47, and one of the things that he sees is he sees this small stream coming down from the temple, and an angelic figure leads him along in his vision. It says it leads him along, he leads him along 1,000 cubits, a cubit's like 1.5 feet. So he leads him along a stretch, and then the small stream has grown, so now he's standing up to his knees. Then he goes another 1,500 feet, and then it's up to his waist, and he goes another length, and then it's just completely covering the whole earth, and it's giving life to the whole earth, and there's trees all around and birds. It's really an image of restoration. In a time where the temple's been destroyed, the people have experienced war, and a lot of them have been deported to a foreign country. There's this vision of this little stream coming from the restored temple and giving life to the whole area, which is actually a desert area. But it's a real strong image of life associated with the temple, God's presence, and the restoration of the people and so forth. And then you have that same image of the river picked up in Revelation at the very end of John's vision. And he also sees a stream. You might want to look at that, actually. Revelation 22. This is the very end of his vision. Somebody want to begin reading perhaps 22, 1 through 5 would be appropriate.
Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Nothing accursed will be found there anymore, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. And there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever.
Okay, thank you. This is the very conclusion of this whole vision. The new heaven and the new earth is reference to this stream of life. So we have this here in 4, there's a river whose streams make glad the city of God. It's again the reference to Jerusalem, the holy habitation of the Most High God. So you have once again waters tie in, but now it's this life-giving image of waters that gladden. And something else we might note is that in 6, these forces of chaos become the armies, or human forces, and also we have movement to a city, which is also a sort of a cultural or human image. Whereas up here, you know, God is our fortress, our refuge and strength and help and so forth. They're very abstract, general. In this, you move to the more specific location of the city of God, Jerusalem, and the small stream, and so forth. And so it seems to be a sort of a movement from the cosmic to sort of the human level of the city. So here we have this city. Now, what's special about this city here?
That it will not be moved?
And won't be moved. Mm-hmm. So it too has that kind of sure foundation. Won't be moved. God's because God's in the midst of it, and God will help when the morning dawns. So help also. If you remember in the very first verse, God is our refuge and strength, the very present help. God will help it when the morning dawns. So another echo there of that. So this is about the city here as a place, a kind of a refuge. Right, so the city becomes the refuge here.
Might the morning dawn refer to the attack of an army? Isn't that when they always attack?
I think that's a good interpretation of that. And I think it has another resonance too in that. In the Psalms, it seems that God often answers prayers in the morning. that you cry, you at night, there's tears and so forth, and in the morning God hears your prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true, that's good.
So, but I think that it might have resonance as well, is that you would generally have a morning attack because there's not a lot of artificial lights. Mm-hmm. So it would be hard to mount an attack in the evening unless it was some kind of surprise ambush or something.
Well, I've heard that's the only time everybody knows what time it is. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. You know, the important meetings always take place at dawn. Attacks always take place at dawn. So it's the only time that everybody knows.
So you couldn't synchronize
your watches.
Synchronize your watches.
Okay. But, I don't know.
But the sun
because the armies are there, it just seemed possible.
I think that's an excellent observation. Because the nations are in uproar, comes right after that. So it could be a time of army attack. But also it has that resonance, I think, of God hearing prayers in the morning,
right.
Too.
Right.
So it may have that double sense.
Mm-hmm.
What I like about this, one of the things I like about this song, it seems that the descriptions of chaos, upheaval, they become shorter and shorter as the song progresses. So in the first stanza, you have this description of the mountains and the sea in sort of chaotic tumult. And then from all 4 to 5, the emphasis is on the city and the refuge as a place of refuge and security. So it's a longer section here about the city, and then the armies come, the nations are in uproar, the kingdoms totter. He utters his voice, the earth melts. So once again, you have God stepping in right away there. So it's like sort of a shorter description of the chaos. And this stanza then ends with this refrain, "The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge." And you see that again where?
Verse 1 and verse 11.
Yes, that's right. Verse 11 is an exact repetition. The Lord of hosts is with us. Mm-hmm. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Going back, the word refuge then points you back to the first line. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. So 7 is really a kind of refrain that points back to this first line. Some biblical scholars try to think that you should put the refrain in again here, that maybe it slipped out. And that would work fine, but you already have that statement actually as sort of the keynote of the whole psalm. So it's fine the way it is too, because it just recalls the opening line here.
Isn't there an argument though that the argument really isn't how the psalms were used? It was used liturgically, you needed that antiphon at the beginning, and then a couple of times in the middle, and at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so much the meaning of the psalm that's at issue here, but the how it was used in worship, I think.
Mm-hmm. That would make sense. You have psalms such as Psalm 136 that have a constant refrain of
steadfast love endures forever.
Your steadfast love endures forever. Mm-hmm. So you would have a congregation, much as we have, learn one line, and then there would be development or articulation of sort of a more complex idea by an individual. So
it's pretty important, isn't it, what line is chosen for that refrain?
Mm-hmm.
What's the most important thing to say over and over?
Mm-hmm. And here, the Lord of hosts is with us, the God of Jacob is our refuge. This is interesting, the image of the Lord of hosts really resonates with the whole psalm too. Hosts, we usually think of hosts as, having guests, but actually hosts is armies. The modern Hebrew word is the same, Tzeva is army. So it's, Tzevaot, it's God of armies. So it's actually a military description for God. And the mythological background of that is that the stars, constellations, were seen as God's armies. And you see sometimes in some of the oldest poetry in the Hebrew Bible, for example, in Judges 5, you see the stars fighting. So it's kind of a mythological ring to it. Mm-hmm.
So it's not the heavenly host of cherubim and seraphim that we see in the beginning of Isaiah.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
It's.
I think it comes to have that resonance too.
Okay. The host. Is that a later development? That with all the hosts of heaven,
mm-hmm.
who praise you? I mean, what are we saying in the softness of the
mm-hmm.
heavenly host?
Heavenly host, meaning sort of the choirs or whatever.
Well, yeah, I thought of those as mm-hmm. the stars, but mm-hmm. more that sort of the creatures who would be angels or whatever
mm-hmm.
who live.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
No, I think you're onto something that the sense of host is as armies is not retained.
Okay.
But
but maybe the hosts are transformed in the heavenly realm, you know, from armies to mm-hmm. other groups of people in all the same uniform.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to sort of remain. No, transformed with the same thing of lots of people mm-hmm. being powerful.
Right.
But just
powerful.
Different mm-hmm. in the different mm-hmm. situations.
In this particular psalm, I think the Lord of Armies
yeah.
really rings true because you have all this imagery of war.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have that sense of it brought forth.
Well, then could it also mean that the Lord of Armies could it mean that every human army is at best penultimate in its power because there is actually God of armies, like Lord of Lords and King of Kings, and do you know?
Mm-hmm.
Well, but I mean, the sense that whatever human armies are doing, there is one who is stronger yet.
Mm-hmm.
The Lord of Hosts is one who mm-hmm. is stronger than the strongest human military might.
Mm-hmm. I think that idea is actually brought forth in verses 8-10 of the Psalm too. So.
Mm-hmm. Maybe another word for armies would be like forces.
Forces.
Because
mm-hmm.
there's, then you have your messengers, your song choirs, you know, whoever they are, but the Lord's, it's just not limited to the military, but has all the power of communication and movement and power.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good point. Okay, so that Lord of Hosts becomes to have a broader range of meanings, but here I think that since God appears as the one who's stronger than all of these armies, and we'll see as we see in the next line, he's very much involved in military operations of a certain type. The figure of the Lord of the Armies being with the people is a very strong one. And this reputation, the God of Jacob is our refuge, drawing us back up to the first line there. Very nice example of the kind of parallelism or thought line that you have in the Psalms a lot, where you have one idea expressed and then kind of echoing. They didn't have rhyme at the end of the lines, you know, sound rhyme, but often would express an idea and then express a similar idea or the opposite or something like that, sort of play. There's often these two lines that have some kind of relationship, either as a synonym or antonym, or maybe they develop a certain idea or a certain word. Here we have more or less a kind of echoing. The Lord, of course, is with us, God Jacob is our refuge. Okay, so going down into the final verse, we have an invitation. We had statements up above, statements of confidence and statements of the chaos that the world finds itself in, description of the city of refuge where God dwells, and how sure it is, even though the nations are in uproar. And now you have a kind of invitation in 9 to observe what's happened here with this kind of setup, these kind of contrasts between chaos and the kind of sure place of refuge we have set up in these. Now we have kind of the results here, this juxtaposition. And what do you see here? It's kind of unexpected. Come behold the works of the Lord, see what desolations he has brought on the earth. Oh, now it seems like almost that God's involved in these kind of desolations, destructions that war brings. And your heart almost skips a beat because you don't expect that. You expect a kind of rescue, right, from these kind of desolations. But now he's involved in these desolations on earth. But then there's a redefinition of the whole concept of desolation, right? What kind of war does God lead here?
His war is to cease the war,
mm-hmm.
to break the bow and
mm-hmm.
the spear.
Mm-hmm. So it's an unexpected redefinition of the type of war that he's waging. War against war, almost, right? So there's a violent destruction of the means of destruction. Makes war cease to the end of the earth, breaking the bow, shattering the spear, burning the shields with fire. Yeah.
Right there, I think of those cherubim, seraphim in Revelation with their flaming swords.
Mm.
And it suddenly popped into my head the Star Wars. So, I mean, I wondered about that. There's a very conscious mythological quality to the Star Wars
mm-hmm.
stuff. And for me, part of it is the power of those, they almost use flaming swords. You know,
yes,
what they
true.
Fight with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are thrilled by that. I remember the first time I saw the very first of the Star Wars, people were just excited. I mean, it was a new movie, but I think part of it is that fighting with fire.
Are you picking up on he burns the shields with fire?
Yeah. I think that that's an image that we culturally kind of like, and it just reminds me of those angels with their swords of fire.
Hmm.
You almost wonder if he uses the cosmic chaos to break the armies.
Yeah.
I mean, who's in directing that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because there is a combination of the natural forces and the tumult among forces of humanity, maybe, the armies. The earth melts. You sort of see earthquakes or, what's that called? Volcanoes
mm-hmm.
and things happening here that are natural forces and at work, that are also part of God's creation,
mm-hmm.
but would certainly overwhelm any army.
Mm-hmm. 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 A good point. There seems to always be kind of a natural and a human level going on throughout the whole thing. So then after you have this invitation to see these desolations, which actually end up being the destruction of the instruments of war itself, then this is quite unexpected, perhaps. They have a little oracle at the end. And usually people think of Psalms as the human prayer to God, either hymns of praise or laments or psalms of confidence or whatever. But here within the psalm itself, you have a direct divine speech, which you usually associate with prophecy. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted in the earth. And this is nice because being exalted among the nations brings to mind these armies, these human armies, and exalted in the earth brings to mind these cosmic forces. You always have that interplay, as you were suggesting in this psalm. Nothing's happening only on sort of the level of sort of history or whatever, but there's always sort of an interplay there. Be still and know that I am God. This is a similar utterance is heard at the point of the Exodus. In Exodus 14, when the people are afraid, the Egyptians are running after them, and the people are afraid, and Moses tells them that God's going to fight for them. All they have to do is just be still. They don't have to fight. So the image is that God fights for the people. They don't have to take on these foes that seem too much for anybody to defeat. And then we go back to our statement, our refrain, which is also our statement of confidence here. Okay. People see other things that they want to bring out that we haven't covered?
Banana.
Okay.
Point well taken.
Well, I'll toss out an idea if I may. I worked with a women's group on a Bible study once, trying to work out a sort of Lutheran perspective on peacemaking, and we worked a lot with this psalm because it is so strongly identified with the Lutheran church, and our tradition is so kind of bound to this psalm. And these last verses are really where we, these eight women, came to kind of claim a Lutheran perspective on peacemaking, because here it seems that God really announces God's self to be against war, breaking all the weapons, smashing the material of war. And the counsel that we seem to get here to be effective peacemakers is to be still. To know God would be the way to peace. And after like a whole weekend retreat working on this, that's kind of the nutshell of what we came out with, but it has helped me see this psalm as having a different perspective than just the fortress thing that we take as Lutherans in our culture, in our upbringing, and kind of change gears and have a different kind of empowerment.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. What could that mean to be still, I wonder? Did you reflect on that?
Well, we took it to mean initially stop fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And or stop arguing and take time to know God, mm-hmm. or try to know God and see maybe God's way through a conflict. But initially, just a very simple be still to us kind of equal stop fighting.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And then it's accompanied by the, I mean, it's not enough alone, it's accompanied by know God.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bruce, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, the image that comes to my mind is a little bit more cataclysmic. Going back to the Star Wars thing that came into my head, I also think of these apocalyptic films that came out during that time, like Mad Max and that sort of thing, where you see the world after a nuclear holocaust or something, and you sort of see everything shattered and broken, and there's smoking, burning things around, and the world is totally silenced. All the works of man have been destroyed. And then in those films, there is not a voice saying, be still and know that I am God. But I think the possibility of a world silent and the works of man destroyed is a very powerful image for our culture as it was for them. I think that's sort of an imagination for us, to imagine all of this craziness, all these cell phones and email, everything gone, the world empty, and then it's still, and then this voice speaks, I am God. There's a part in, I'm not sure where it is biblically, is it Isaiah, where Elijah says, but it's in the Mendelssohn oratorio, where he says, my voice is not in the whirlwind, my voice is not this, my voice is not this, my voice is not this, but in that moment of silence, absolute silence, there is my voice, and all of the orchestral and choral forces at that point in the oratorio are just so quiet and so still, and then God says, and that is my voice there. In the midst of all this chaos, it finally is gone. I think we almost culturally hope for a cataclysmic event. It's so strong in our imagination, and we just wish that God would come in at the end of it and say, clean all this up. This is my world, not yours, sir.
What I think what you're saying, you're pointing out that there's a very strong sort of mythological undertone to this whole psalm. And if we had more time, we could go into that. It's the image of God as warrior that you see throughout a number of the psalms. And you also see the same sort of myth in the Babylonian culture, the larger Mesopotamian culture of the time, where the king of the gods, Marduk, for example, fights the forces of chaos, the watery sea monster, slaughters her, and through that act becomes supreme king, and then also separates her body, opens up it, and creates the world, and then builds his palace or his, you know, the temple and so forth, so becomes supreme and rules over the floods and so forth. So there's this myth of the divine, the sort of the cosmic battle that's behind all this, even though it's not expressed explicitly here. In other psalms it is, like Psalm 74 talks about God slaying a leviathan, the sea creature, and then establishing the world and so forth. And if you look at Exodus 15, even that psalm, that song after the Exodus, I will sing unto the Lord for he has triumphed gloriously and so forth. If you read further on, it talks about the Egyptians being thrown into the water, but it also talks about a split of a body of water. So it's that motif of splitting the waters, and it goes on, it leads the people, he leads the people to his abode, his sanctuary, where he founds it, he reigns forever. So those motifs of fighting the forces of chaos, being victorious, and then setting up sort of the temple. That's interesting because there's the city of God imagery in here too, where God dwells and so he becomes king. So I think that there's this myth behind this psalm that you're drawing up that's continued in our culture.
Kind of terrifying thing here, if this is Martin Luther's psalm, I mean, was it called the 30 Years' War that happened just sort of subsequent to and consequent to the Reformation and terrible devastation in Europe at that time, as though it was being borne out.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mark has another interpretation of the context.
I'd heard that Luther wrote A Mighty Fortress at the time that the Ottoman Empire was, the Turks were really starting to push up toward Austria. They were basically at the doorstep of Vienna. And so Luther talks about the hordes of devils filling the land all ready to devour us. He has a very specific people in mind. So there are a number of, I think, world forces out there that he's got in mind when Psalm 46 is
interpreted by. And then after the class, I looked at the hymnal companion to the Lutheran Book of Worship. So if we want to complicate it further, we have the 30 Years' War, we have the Ottoman attack, and then there's another theory here that it was written to interpret and apply the psalm to the church of its own time and its struggles. Possibly written, inspired by the Diet of Spires in 1529, at which German princes protested against the revocation of their liberties, giving rise to the term Protestant. So there's a number of different interpretations that all pick up on different aspects of the hymn and different possible resonances within history.
I've heard it referred to as the Battle Hymn of the Reformation.
The Battle Hymn of the Reformation. Well, I think that maybe we should sing that hymn at this point and see what aspects of the psalm are picked up, what gets left out, and how it's been used in the church. Do you have hymns up there? This is 229 in the Lutheran Book of Worship.
Thank you.
changes or the emphases that you see in here?
We seem to have lost a lot of the cosmic chaos.
That's interesting you say that. Because there's not the mountains and the lawns?
Yeah, most of the imagery is in battle imagery and armies. And, I mean, I guess the foe is the hordes of devils. But
the hordes of devils. So you have a kind of cosmic dimension, but yeah, you don't have the mountains and the oceans anymore, but now it's the hordes of devils and the old satanic foe.
There's certainly too a shift. I mean, the thing that God is using to fight the armies is shifted from the cosmic chaos to Jesus Christ.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Jesus is now the image. His only Son is the one who's come to lead us mm-hmm. in battle.
So we have God's word then, verse 4, abiding forever. And it's weapons of the Spirit that means through which this victory is accomplished. Yes, and that's right, the Lord of hosts in verse 3 at the bottom. The Lord of hosts is He, Christ Jesus, mighty Lord. So there's an identification there of the Lord of hosts as Jesus, Christ Jesus.
I don't get a lot of that sense of be still and know I am God.
It has sort of a martial feel to it, sort of a march, right? Which is appropriate to the imagery of war and so forth, but it's the be still, yes, it's not present either in the music or in the words.
Yeah, it's a little more about our salvation than God's exaltation. Here in the psalm, I'm exalted. And here it's sort of more about we have a victory, or at least salvation. We're saved from, even though we might be dead and battered, we can still have the kingdom.
Have the kingdom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I notice that Jerusalem is gone. Mm-hmm. Along with Jerusalem, what to do with Jerusalem? Often that Jerusalem is, you know, spiritualized in the church's interpretation as heaven or even sort of an image of Christ, metaphor for Christ. So, but it's not part of the imagery here in the hymn.
I don't think this is a hymn paraphrase of an entire psalm.
I think you're right there.
Mm-hmm. I think this is really based on a couple of verses. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Luther would claim that this really is the whole psalm here. He's taken a few verses out and made an entire hymn. And it was his want to see Jesus everywhere, mm-hmm. Especially all over the Psalter. Mm-hmm. So I, as a total hymn, as a total psalm paraphrase, this falls, mm-hmm. as my daughter would say, way short. But I think we do the hymn a disservice to ask it of that, because I don't think that was intended from the beginning. Mm-hmm. It really is just about that antiphon in some way, what it means to call God fortress, and when you do, what you know you can lose and risk because of what is sure and steadfast. So,
mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
See, he's not Calvinistic when it comes to the psalms. Mm-hmm. You know, that basically you have to just find new ways to sing the whole psalm. Mm-hmm. It's really written a hymn inspired by a psalm. I mm-hmm. think there's sort of a difference mm-hmm. there.
Yeah, emphasizing that a mighty fortress, that whole idea, and then drawing images from the psalm
yeah.
throughout
yeah.
of the battle imagery, the Lord of Hosts, world's tyrants raging. So he's drawing from more of the psalm than just the first line. But you're absolutely right. And I wish that, I think I actually have a Presbyterian hymnal of Psalm 46, but I didn't bring it.
Oh, I have one upstairs.
Yeah, so that they probably would just have pretty much a paraphrase, but other comments?
Yeah, which says something about Lutheran creativity in music and worship and liturgy, you know, and the way that he would bring this into the, you know, his theology and context.
Yeah, it's more to make it contemporary, to make it speak to his time, which might sort of enforce the kind of thing that Anne's group of women's doing too, looking at the psalm again and thinking, well, what might that mean in our context as well? So it would be a model, even though perhaps a different result or a different product, it would be kind of a model for a very creative type of exegesis mm-hmm. of a psalm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, did you want to say something back there?
Well, this won't surprise you, but it reminds me of baptism and the sort of fight with the Satan and devil and the evil that happens in baptism, and how through baptism Christ is victorious, and we, after baptism, then are in God's fortress. And in the Large Catechism, when Luther's talking about when you're being oppressed by the devil or by evil thoughts or whatever, to turn to that, the Satan, or to the evil thoughts and say, but I'm baptized. And this line, one little word subdues him, struck me as sort of Luther's feisty personality, just claiming your baptism and saying, you know, as Betsy has jokingly said this week, go to hell, Satan. You know, leave me alone. I'm baptized. So.
Another thing is that this version, 229, mm-hmm. this isn't what Martin Luther had in mind.
Oh, okay. So this is more...
this is Bach. Bach did this. He took Martin Luther's hymn and turned it into a chorale, a four-part chorale, and really, really smoothed it out and civilized it. 228 is much closer to what Luther had in mind.
Which
but even
not,
at that, the German language fits the rhythms very in a very harsh and martial and powerful way. It really sounds almost primitive, primitively militaristic in with the German and the original rhythms.
Yeah, when I think of the words Festeburg,
Festeburg is unser Gott.
Yeah, we're not thinking beautifully Baroque palaces. We're talking hard rock that's really cold and has a few fireplaces.
Yeah.
Maybe a few.
I think it's peculiar that the Lutherans have taken Bach's version of it. I'm glad the hymnal has both in there, but this 229 is the one we sing.
Well,
and 228 is just a little, it's a little edgy for civilized people.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. I'm struck by Anne's group and compelled, drawn by this idea of being still in the middle of all of this chaos, the earth's upheaval, the chaos in cities, the chaos between armies, and being still. That appeals to me. However, I think we have to be careful not to remove from our lexicon of faith images of doing battle. Because there still is battle to be done, and I have to be very careful about the language I use so that you don't put me in a little camp where I don't want to be. But there are principalities and powers. There is evil at work yet in the world. It isn't, there is a spiritual warfare that's being fought.
But the be still isn't be still forever, is it? I mean, isn't it partly just be still for a minute and know this and then
starting point?
Continue.
Well, I think the be still, as Anne says, has to be connected to the know that I am God, that in the middle of this, let there be a place where you hear the voice, the still small voice, where you know that God still is more powerful than all of the chaos and tumult that you see. But I guess I'm responding in part to this Bach harmonization, making a chorale out of this. we kind of recoil at anything that feels marchy or militaristic.
Yeah, yeah.
And I among those recoil at that. I don't particularly care to sing this hymn anymore, frankly. But I have to ask myself, then do I live in the denial that we still are not about a battle? That evil is still powerful among us, the forces it. And I'm not talking about going to war and killing people or seeking the death penalty for the three white men who brutally murdered the black man as if this is somehow going to quell the forces of evil. But I guess I just wonder, all I want to say is we need to be aware of not removing from our lexicon of faith language of being in battle.
Mm-hmm. Because I think to do so gets rid of that's very powerful.
But see, this song can lead us to places we don't want to go either and shouldn't go. Yeah. It can stir up nationalistic pride. It can stir up
the kingdom's
Protestant
forever.
Pride as if our
that's right.
The battle line is between us and the Pope. Or I mean, it can raise up things in us that are not godly or helpful or of peace or of Christ. Mm-hmm. But it also can stir us to a kind of passion for peace and passion for the reign of God to break in, which still involves resisting evil. Mm-hmm.
Any last words? I think we'll probably just end there since we've, unless people clamor to